historical Dartmouth?
Well, it's very nice not to be fighting the politics of first year brownie points, and it's very lovely to be here in this excellent climate. And so thank you very much, Torsten and Roya and Meran, and I think Adrian's on the committee, for inviting me. What I want to talk about today is something that, well, these force laws might seem strange to some people, they might not seem strange to others, but let's see. What I want to talk about is systems that have low dimensionality in one direction and are very large in another and are close to being metallic, that is, they're zero gap electronic systems. And so in this category would come metallic nanotubes attracting here or attracting that way, graphene planes, I'm going to do the zero temperature case today, two metallic 2D sheets, various of these things, plus a metal substrate, which can somewhat mimic, by image type physics, can mimic another of these said systems. Mostly what I've done is done this in the asymptotic limit where there's no overlap of the electronic clouds. My focus has been on the matter, and so I'm also interested in the very difficult limit of where these things are going on, but you bring the systems together so the electronic clouds could overlap. And this is a very nasty problem with sort of quantum chemical overtones. I won't say much about that today, but I have a serious interest in that, and it's hard. The cases I was able to solve for these distant interactions, if you believe the inputs, then the theory is actually quite simple, and I'll show you some of that today. And rather than getting straight into the mathematics, I want to do about half the talk on hand-waving. Sorry about this, but I think it's probably better to wave the hands for a bit to see why these things are happening before I just crunch a few equations and show that they've happened. So because I think a lot of people here are interested in focusing on the fields, the electromagnetic fields in Casimir, I want to do an absolutely baby treatment of approaches that focus on the matter rather than the field. I'm interested in the limit where electromagnetic retardation is not important, so I'm going to simply use the instantaneous Coulomb potentials, no retardation. I'm also not going to be interested here in finite temperature, though most of this can be done also for finite temperature. So the simplest way of looking at this van der Waals type effects from the matter point of view is to imagine two systems, let's say spherically symmetrical atoms, just for definiteness, that have a Hartree field outside them which decays exponentially. So certainly static physics would not produce any attraction at large distance, or an exponentially decaying interaction specifically. However, of course, random motions of the electrons, either thermal if it's finite temperature or zero-point quantum motions, can produce a short-lived dipole, which of course produces a field at the other system of order dipole moment over distance cubed. And that field acting at the second atom induces a dipole, so there's an induction here, and alpha 2 is the polarizability of the second atom. It's a very, very rough argument. I think Neil Ashcroft showed this to me first, actually. It's probably where this came from. Then, of course, the second dipole produces a field back at the first dipole, which all this happening instantaneously. This produces an energy, a force on the first system, and hence an energy, force times the original dipole, which is proportional to the square of the original fluctuating dipole. And of course, the averages of squares don't go to zero. So this is an effect which isn't zero on average, even though the average of D, the original dipole, would be zero over time. So there's the time-averaged energy. It comes out this way, and if you make, just to get order of magnitudes, you make a simple harmonic oscillator model, for example, of one of these atoms for its fluctuations or vibrations, you can then relate the square of the dipole to the polarizability of that system times some characteristic frequency of the system. Well, that's a very rough argument, but it has a lot of the essential features that are right. A more accurate treatment, which is basically the Casimir-Polder formula in the dipole approximation, gives you an integral of the polarizabilities over all imaginary frequencies instead of just a product of dipole polarizabilities multiplied by a frequency. So this is the basic, simplest argument you can make, and there's a lot of physics that you can learn from that, from this matter-oriented approach. Firstly, the second dipole is only oriented that way when the first one is oriented its way, and so this is an effect of correlations between the matter motions on the two systems. So there's certainly a correlation energy effect if you want to look at it that way. It's a highly non-local effect, And so in the conventional way, at least, of looking at density functional approximations, the local and local gradient approximations aren't going to give you this for well-separated matter. Now, I know Walter's interested in the sort of Feynman-Tozer argument, where you can, in fact, get van der Waals forces directly from a very accurate calculation of the density. So I'm not going to talk about that way of doing it. But from this way of looking at it, this is an effect of non-local correlations.
Quick comment.
Yeah.
I do say that sometimes because occasionally people feel, well, this is a shortcoming of density function.
No such thing.
And, in practical terms, yes.
Absolutely. It's a shortcoming of the LDA and of all known GGAs, but there are certainly functionals around which are functionals only of the ground state density and which explicitly put in van der Waals. There are several of them around. So it's certainly not a failing of DFT as such, simply a failing of the local approximations. Another way of looking at this is you can see it's got two powers of this Coulomb dipole field. So at second order perturbation theory and the inter-system interaction will get you basically this physics, at least for finite systems like these. Clearly, alpha polarizability is a response function, so response functions come into it. There's another way of doing it, which I haven't got a picture for, but if you simply solve the coupled motions of two springy dipoles on two systems and then look at the zero-point energy of the coupled motions, you can also get a similar one on R6 corner. So there's many, many ways of looking at this from the matter point of view.
So omega zero is that... It's changing the frequency between the ground state.
Yeah, it would be some sort of excitation frequency. Of
design the ground state?
They start, well, yes, they're in the ground state, that's right. And we're looking at zero-point fluctuations to initiate this.
It would be different if the atoms are...
If they're in a thermal state, for example, there could be thermal fluctuations.
If it would prepare one of the atoms.
Oh yes, I believe there are cases where even in these simple things you can get repulsions, for example. This is always attractive because it basically lowers the ground state energy, so it's going to
be
attractive.
Retarded van der Waals effect is even the theoretically more simpler one because you don't need this omega zero scale.
Well, the properties of the matter become almost unimportant in the highly retarded limit.
Then you have your over 7 law to get the dimensions right. And this corresponds basically, this would be really the low energy limit of everything, right?
All right. So I'm not going to talk about retardation at all. It would be insulting to show that graph to people here who know all about it. I'm going to talk about a so-called conventional view. Now, this probably isn't the conventional view in this meeting, but for many, many solid-state physicists who try to model the interactions between nanostructures, the conventional view goes like this. All right, if atoms have a 1 on R6 attractive energy, if you've got a lot of atoms, you simply look at all pairs of atoms as a first approximation, add up those 1 on R6 energies. Most people who do this also recognize that there are terms for 3 atoms at a time, mutual polarization of 2 of them while interacting with a third, sure. But they say these may make a difference to the coefficients, but certainly they wouldn't change the power law, you know, 1 on D3, 1 on D4, whatever it is. So they don't make a qualitative difference. That's the common view in solid-state physics. Now, obviously, I'm going to say that this is not right for some systems. So let's see what that common view would say. For example, two bulk pieces of material with a planar interfaces, distant capital D. I'll mostly use this for the distance between the systems. A simple argument of adding up 1 on R6 just on dimensional grounds. You take a point here and add it up with all the others. It'll give you D to the minus 2 for the energy of interaction. And much more sophisticated theories, the Lifshitz type, Jilashinsky-Lifshitz type theories, based on the random phase approximation, in fact, if you look closely, they also give that result. And most people believe it's right, and even I believe it's right for bulk systems. So I put a tick on that. Let's take the same argument applied to thin systems. So we're getting into systems which I think are interesting from the point of view of this talk. And a similar straight-out dimension really gives you that the energy for two thin planar systems separated much more than their thickness should go as D minus 4. And equally, the two very long thin systems should have an energy going like D minus 5 by adding up 1 on R6. And so all these different powers of D that emerge, I mean, they're not all different rules, though. They're in some sense universal in the special sense. By universal, I simply mean that they're what you get by adding up the same force law, 1 on R6 between the point atoms or whatever elements in the systems. What I'm going to claim is that this is not right for these two cases on this page when the two systems are metallic and they're metals. Zero gap systems. Also, I'm going to claim it's not right when the two planar systems are graphene at zero temperature, which is somewhere between a metal and a semiconductor.
Semi-metal.
Well, yeah, it's a zero gap semiconductor, or it's a zero density of states metal. Take your pick, but it's neither fish nor fowl, basically. Okay, so let me summarise. This is just a preview. I haven't proved anything here. I'm just going to quote you the results that I've come up with for these systems. Not all these results are new by any means. I've reinvented some wheels I discovered recently. Certainly some of these cases were known. So let's look at the planar systems first. The results that I'm going to claim are the following. here's the standard, so-called standard or universal result. D to the minus 4 for the interaction energy of two planes, and I'm going to claim that that's correct for insulating or semiconducting systems. It's been known for some time, in fact probably for a very long time, that actually if you take perfect 2D metals, that is 2D gelium, and interact them, the law is in fact D to the minus 5 halves. It's to do with basically long wavelength plasmons coupling between the two, and the plasmons have a square root dispersion law, so it's not too surprising that a minus 5 halves comes out. The one that I believe really is new that no one did before, I've done this case for graphene, two graphene planes at zero temperature, and the answer there is, perhaps not surprisingly, somewhere in between the insulating and the metal result. It's D to the minus 3, closer if anything to the metallic result than to the insulating one. You get even more spectacular differences for the 1D metallic systems, and my student and I thought we derived this for the first time in about 2001, but in fact it's been done at least twice before, and one of them was in the 70s, so a lot of wheel reinventing goes on, I'm afraid, and certainly it does in our place. So the results there are quite striking. The sum of 1 on R6 gives you a D minus 5 energy, whereas the result of just to jump the gun a bit, the result of coupling one-dimensional plasmons between the two systems gives you D to the minus 2 with a logarithmic correction, so nearly three powers of D different. I'll talk a bit later about whether you might be able to observe this. It's not as easy to observe as that big power difference sounds.
Exponent on the log, that's something which is non-universal, I guess.
That whole formula is non-universal in the sense that you don't get it by adding 1 on R6.
Exact calculation. The 3 half, is it easy to understand where they come from?
I will show you where it's dependent. No, it's a geometry. Well, I'm sorry. It comes from the peculiar Fourier transform of the Coulomb potential in 1D, which has a log in it.
It
comes from the plasmon dispersion, which is almost acoustic in 1D metals. But not quite. It's got a log correction.
So for your graphene there, pi conjugated, you called it. Mm-hmm. How do you get the pi and sigma bonds of graphene?
I'll show you. Incidentally, I would say that in real systems, of course, the metallic electrons are only some of the electrons. Of course, for DC conductivity, it's only the electrons near the Fermi surface that matter, and the electrons in full bands are not interesting. But for van der Waals, of course, you can't ignore them. So any system that has a metallic band of electrons, true, it'll have its interactions, but you can't forget also the interactions of the other electrons, which are insulating, if you want to make a crude thing. So these are not the whole story, and that's another reason why this is going to be hard to see. All right, so broadly, what causes the strange powers? And if you come from a Lifshitz way of thinking, which looks at the van der Waals interaction in terms of the dielectric response of the two systems, it comes because the dielectric response in the two component systems is very non-local. And of course, dielectric responses are always non-local, but they're usually non-local on quite a short length scale. In these systems, the dielectric response is non-local in a very grand scale, and that's, if you like, the reason for this, why you don't get the same law as Lifshitz. So there are,
Say what non-local means?
Yeah, sure. What I mean is, what I mean by local is that epsilon of r, r primed and omega goes like delta, right? Whereas non-local, it means there's a separate dependence on r and r prime, and nothing like this. Okay. And another way of looking at it, at least in a bulk system where you can Fourier transform at will, then it means that epsilon of q is a function of q. That's non-local. And we'll see an example quite explicitly. For a 3D metal, for example, epsilon of q to lowest order in q is not q dependent, so that's what I'd call a local epsilon. So that's local. Right? And in 2D and 1D, the corresponding Fourier transformed epsilon is a strong function of Q. That's the reason for these things. Right, so there are two... I'd like to make two cases where I think this can happen. Obviously, I think A is the more interesting. You can get strange powers of D at large separations when you have these non-local epsilons. And I'm talking about large separations, but still not so large that electromagnetic retardation takes over. The other case, which is perhaps more obvious, you can get unusual power laws if your two systems are not overlapped yet, so the electronic charges are not overlapped, but you're closer together or at a distance apart, D, that's comparable to one of the microscopic lengths of either system, the internal length. So, for example, if you're... I'll talk about that in a moment, but if you're distant apart in a system that has a Debye length or a more likely a classical... the classical Debye length in a classical plasma, if two plasmas are closer together than that Debye length, you're obviously not in the asymptotic regime, and power laws can be considerably slower than one on D squared or whatever conventional theory would predict. So this bottom one's not at all surprising, and I won't spend very long on it. Top one, I think, is more surprising. So so it's the non-locality is tied up in these cases that I'm interested in with the response at low omega and low Q. And when the response blows up at low Q in a way which depends strongly on Q and on omega, then those are the cases where it's interesting. So you might think, well, the obvious type of system that would have a non-local dielectric response might be a metal. This is wrong, but it's what you might at first think if you didn't think about it, because after all, you push on the metal with an electric field here, the electrons can go long distances, and maybe that'll cause polarization to occur at far parts of the system. Well, of course, we know that's wrong in 3D because of Coulomb screening. In 3D systems, Coulomb screening is basically complete. At small q and small omega. And so if we examine, for example, in an infinite 3D system, a metal, the dielectric function, it's 1 minus the Coulomb potential times the bare density-density response. I'll define that a bit later. And if you look at it, the density-density response has a factor q squared, and the Coulomb interaction has a 1 on q squared in Fourier space, and so the q dependences cancel, and you get a plasma, bulk plasma, 3D dielectric response, which is independent of q. This is the basic reason why Lifshitz-like formulae work for metals as well as insulators, that the dielectric function is essentially local, at least on a distance scale in both cases. But do exactly the same thing for a 2D metal, and you get something different. In two dimensions, the Coulomb potential only goes like 1 on Q, not like 1 on Q squared. This is a 2D plane in 3D space, by the way. Then you find that the dielectric function can be written much the same way as for 3D, 1 minus the plasma frequency squared on omega squared, but in 2D, because of this different nature of the Coulomb potential, the plasma frequency is strongly dependent on Q. It's a root Q dependence. Q parallel just means Q in the plane, if you see a parallel on my Qs. Right, so there you've got a non-local dielectric function, and that's the basic reason, if you want to think Lifshitz theory, it's the basic reason why two 2D gases give you a different power law, not the same as Lifshitz. And I think I've already said this, this is probably too low for people to see, but it just says that in systems where they're not overlapped in their electronic clouds, but if there's a microscopic length of the system which is comparable to the distance, then obviously you're not in the asymptotic regime and you can't expect the same powers. I have done some cases where that gives you a lower power, so it could perhaps mimic a fifth force, so-called chameleon force. If you're looking for those, you have to be very careful in those cases, like if you're doing it with semiconductors. All right, so just still waving hands. I'm sorry to be waving hands so long after I started, but I want to get these ideas through before I just start crunching cases. So when do I claim you're going to get strange results? The system has to be large in at least, the two interacting systems have to be large in at least one direction so that you can even talk about long wavelengths or Q goes to naught. Secondly, the system should be metallic or have a zero electronic gap. That just means that if it weren't for Coulomb screening, at least, these systems would have a very large response at low frequency and low Q. And the third thing that has to be true for this strange effects to happen is that this had better not be defeated by Coulomb screening the way it was in three dimensions, with strong dependence on Q or non-locality. So you need a system that's nanoscopic, small, in at least one other direction. So these systems have to be very anisotropic before these things happen. They have to be big in at least one dimension and nanoscopically small in another. And then, as in 2D gases, for example, you defeat the complete Coulomb screening and you can get metallic systems to have very non-local epsilons. And by the way, where plasmons are present, they're not always present in the systems I'm interested in, but where they're present, they'll be gapless. The frequency will go to naught as the Q goes to naught. Okay, so that's the general framework. Now,
maybe I'm going to make a semantic remark. can you go back to the first thing?
This one?
Right. So you consider, or you talk about these exponents as strange if they don't...
If they don't obey Lifshitz, if they're not like Lifshitz, or even if they're not like some of one on R6.
Well, that's what it says there,
yeah.
One on R6. Yeah. But, I mean, for many cases, it would be very strange if they were just some of one of R6.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that in hindsight, and I think many people here would because they concentrate on the fields.
If you don't mind my saying so, I don't think that's a good way of introducing strangeness. it is, in fact, not strange.
No, well, it's not surprising in view of what I've said here, right?
Okay.
You know, it's like things are known well to those who know them well, if you see what I mean. Things are well known to those who know them well. And
so this is... All
right, okay. So the formal... I would like to quickly say what formal microscopic theories should do this job. And remember, I'm really interested in theories which will also work in the overlapped regime. And I'm going to make the argument that schemes based on time-dependent response, including time-dependent density functional theory, should be a way to do this problem nicely. Right, so I want to define the density-density response. We imagine basically poking the system with a stick, or actually what I mean is we change the external potential at point R prime, like a delta function external potential, at frequency omega, and we watch at some other place R how the electron number density n of R changes. So this quantity is supposed to tell you that's the change in the electron number density. Now if you have a field that's not at one point but is integrated over many points to give the total field, then if this is to be the linear response, then obviously the answer must for the density must be a linear sum of such things. So that's the formal definition of what I shall mean by the density-density response. It's the retarded response, I think, technically. Now, this can be broken down. You could imagine a so-called cone-sham world in which the ground state potential which generates the ground state density is present, so it's an external potential, but you switch off the interaction between the electrons. So they just independent electrons. Of course, that response function is relatively simple to calculate. You can calculate that from one-body physics. We'll call that chi for lambda equals naught. Lambda is the strength of the Coulomb interaction between the particles inside your system. So if the bare response chi naught or chi cone sham is known, then you might imagine that in reality the electrons respond with that bare response not just to the external field but to an internal field as well. And in a Hartree world, that internal field would just be the same density response integrated up with the Coulomb potential. Of course, one knows that if there really is an electron at R, the other electrons will avoid it. There are time-dependent correlation effects. So that's not quite true. The density elsewhere is not the same as it would have been without your guy at R that you're asking about. And so those effects are conveniently introduced. I don't know whether you'll like this way of saying this, Walter, but these are introduced in time-dependent DFT via a thing known as the exchange and correlation kernel FXC. If you cross that out, you've got the time-dependent Hartree approximation, which goes into what I shall call the RPA energy. Now,
because I think we introduced
this. That's yours, yes. That's Gross. That's Gross and Cohn, 1986, I think. Gross and Cohn, 1986. But that's the essence of time-dependent density functional theory, at least in the linear regime. And you can write this in diagrams, those who like diagrams, the interacting responses, the bare one plus the bare one integrated up with the potential, this total potential, and chi naught. Now, if you know the density-density response, it turns out you can find all the correlation physics of the ground state by a wonderful thing called the fluctuation-dissipation theorem, which you've all heard of, I'm sure. But before I introduce that, I'd like to just write down something which is known to many solid-state people, at least, as the adiabatic connection formula. The principle of this is as follows. Coulomb is only a pair potential, therefore if you knew the exact pair distribution, you'd have the exact Coulomb energy of the ground state. Not the total energy necessarily, but the exact Coulomb energy. And that would be the Coulomb correlation energy. Unfortunately, in quantum systems, if you keep systems apart, you'll also raise the kinetic energy, particularly in Fermi systems. So that's not the whole of the energy. It's a very clever argument. I'm not sure where it started, but the modern form of it that most solid staters use came from Langreth and Perdue, and independently from Gunnarsson and Lundquist. They have a clever way. They switch on the interaction between the electrons from lambda equals naught to lambda equals one, the true value, and they look at the change in the ground state energy using a Feynman theorem argument. They can show basically that all the correlation energy, including the kinetic part of it, can be got from this apparently Coulomb energy looking expression. What is this? This is just the non-trivial part, the non-Hartree part of the pair distribution. And I've written it in terms of a product of two density fluctuation operators. I could have put another slide here, but there's not space. All right, so let's believe that for the moment. There's a lot of wrinkles on this. Usually this lambda integration is done at constant ground state density. And that's actually very useful in practice when you really try and calculate these things, but that's another story. Now, once you realize that you're looking for the correlation between the density fluctuations in the ground state at two different points, you can use the fluctuation dissipation theorem. This is the zero temperature version that I'm presenting here because I'm working at zero temperature. And that's very simple. It says that the correlations in the ground state can be found from the density-density response to a slightly perturbed state. And so this is the famous adiabatic connection fluctuation dissipation theorem formula. This is the exact energy beyond Hartree of the ground state of an inhomogeneous many-body system. There's no approximations made here, but of course you have to know this very detailed many-body quantity, the density-density response. And that therein lies the rub. A couple of interesting properties of this, though. For example, if you switch off the interactions, so you've got back to lambda naught or lambda cone sham, this thing gives you the exact exchange energy, so-called exact density functional exchange. So this type of theory is a good candidate for going back to the overlap limit of systems. It'll get you a lot of those chemical effects that come from Coulomb exchange. Some more properties of this type of formula. On the next page, I want to point out that you can show, and I did this in 96, I think, you can show that this that the correlation energy from this type of formula, if you now expand it to second order in the Coulomb interaction between two separated systems, gives you back the so-called Casimir-Polder formula. In the dipole approximation, the Casimir-Polder formula is just this rather familiar thing here, which many of you will have seen. So in that sense, this kind of formalism easily contains the van der Waals interaction. All right, so you can read about that there. It wasn't completely trivial because I switched on all the interactions within the systems and between the systems. That still comes out this way, but that's another story. Okay.
The boiler should go like 1/r^7.
Oh, well, it depends whether it's the force or the depends whether it's retarded or not, and whether it's the force or the energy. This is the energy in the non-retarded limit goes like 1/r^6. Yes, I'm sorry. One of my quantum chemists in the meeting I had in Brisbane the other week, I call it the Kohn-Zaremba formula. In fact, the full formula is something like the energy to second order goes like integral dr1 dr1 primed dr2 dr2 primed and 1 on r1 minus r2 1 on r1 minus r something of this sort of the two chi's, chi and system 1, chi and system 2. That's the full formula, and there's some factors out the front. This looks like a 1 on r squared formula, but because these things integrate to 0 over spatial coordinates, in fact, it comes out to go like 1 on r6. So the point here is simply that this if you make the RPA approximation, you don't lose the van der Waals from this exact formula. That's the point. You can make the RPA approximation and not lose the fact that the exact formula contains the van der Waals energy. Just a couple of technical points. So we want the electronic energies of all sorts of extended systems, if possible, of a seamless treatment of the forces at all distances. Response-based scheme, here's the formula. If you solve that formula that relates the bare to the screen response formally, it'll be like this, though in general this thing would be a matrix in R prime space. And so that's the solution of this. If you plug in that expanded solution into the energy, you get this series of diagrams. The only reason I'm really doing this page is that series of diagrams. And this formula, after some manipulation, you can also show that the RPA energy is basically the trace means all spatial integrations. It's the integral of the log of an operator in RR prime space. We'll give you the total correlation energy. Well, what I want to point out, the reason I showed that slide is if you look at Gierlachinsky and Lifshitz, the version where this was done from quantum field theory, here's the diagrams they kept. Sum of rings. So it's they're doing the RPA. The difference between what I'm going to talk about and them is that they allowed the photon line to be a fully dynamical quantity with retardation and dynamics of its own, transverse parts, etc., whereas I'm treating this as an instantaneous Coulomb interaction. So I've legislated away the retardation effects by doing that. Next point I want to make is that this RPA formula contains the sum of the zero-point energies of plasmons. Plasmons are, by definition, the zeros of the determinant of this quantity. That's the frequencies of natural vibration of the electrons. That's what I mean by plasmons in this context. And as it stands, you can take the integration on the imaginary axis and wrap it round to the real axis because response functions have to be analytic in the upper half plane because of causality, but you still may not be able to write this exactly as a sum of plasmon energies. You've got an open contour here. It's not an infinite contour. It's got a finite end. You can't exactly relate this in general to the sum of the energies at the poles. But in fact, if you can assume some more properties other than just causality, remember, we're going to do this for big systems where you can't write the exact response down. You're going to have to make approximations. In fact, it is true that the true RPA energy can be written as the sum of excitation energies. It's proved by a guy called Furcher quite recently. But for big systems with approximate chi's, if you allow... I'm not going to show the details here. If you allow, as in many of the simple models I'm going to show, that the response function is time reversal invariant, then you can actually mess with your contours a bit and show that the RPA energy, which remember contains van der Waals, is the sum of zero-point energies. This is all at zero temperature. Remember, zero-point energies of any poles, that is the plasmon zero-point energies, plus in some of the systems I'll be talking about, the poles are not isolated, they're cuts. They're long strings of poles or cuts. Then you have to include the cut contribution. So in practice, for large many-body systems, the important part that doesn't depend on separation of two systems of the RPA energy is the sum of zero-point energies of the plasmons plus any cut integrals. And they can be important. For example, for graphene, they're the only story. There are no plasmons, and this is the whole answer. So it's quite important that for many-body big systems, it's not quite straightforward to express the van der Waals energy as the sum of zero-point plasmons.
Can I interrupt for a moment?
Yep.
You use the expression large systems.
Infinite systems.
What is large?
It means infinite.
No, it does.
Well, to me it does. What would you like to...
Well, I mean, it doesn't because... if you cut the parts of the systems, or even one system, at some finite distance, just cut it off, throw it away. When that distance becomes large, at which you throw it away, you get a more and more accurate answer. So it's not truly infinite.
No. In practice, what I need for the sort of things I'm talking about to be true, I believe, is that let's just take the planar case as an example. You've got a width and a distance d. And one wants d to be much greater than some microscopic length of the system and much less than the lateral extent of the system. And that's what I shall mean by infinite in practice.
Right. But that is for, this is for a very special geometry. The plates themselves are... parallels.
Oh yeah, all these results I've got are for quite special parallel geometries, I agree. And I think you're only going to get really strange results for those cases, probably.
Well, at the moment I'm not talking about strange, I'm talking about large distances.
All right.
If the systems do not have find the right way of expressing that, if they're not infinite in the xy plane, but are infinite in the z.
Okay, alright. So in fact, that's the case of two nanotubes pointing at each other.
There's some. Yeah. That would be an example.
Yeah, yes.
But even if you just take the simplest case, two spheres. Mm-hmm. And you put them close to each other. Of course, spheres are finite in all directions. But if you put them close to each other, then the leading part of the van der Waals interaction comes from I'll explain what I mean by that in 1 second. Those parts of the spheres that are close to the point of closest approach.
That's certainly what most people assume anyway, yes.
So the fact that they are infinite in the z direction is irrelevant. You can cut everything else off except what is close and that can be defined, what's meant by that, to the point of nearest approach. So there are some, well, I don't know whether they're interesting to you or to anybody else, but there are some issues as to what is meant by large systems.
Okay. I think the things I'm talking about probably only happen when you have large areas of parallelism, either in the linear or the planar case.
Yeah,
I think that's quite probably true.
I think what John is saying here is, suppose you have two nanotubes that are facing each other, like you were saying. Now, he's saying that, in fact, the interaction between them logarithmically depends on how far away you go.
In fact, it's worse than logarithmic. I've got that example at the very end.
And that violates
All right, so basically...
Yes, because I'm talking about a different class of geometry.
I think what I'm calling strange laws happen only in quite special geometries. Sorry.
But for the two-sphere case,
I don't think I have anything to say about that.
It's just a proximity force approximation.
These are essentially bulk systems from this point of view, and they will screen themselves perfectly, even if they're metal. So it's not, you're not going to have these problems. So the upshot of all of this is that in order to analyze these so-called strange cases, I'm going to use the sum of plasmon zero-point energies where poles are the only singularities of the response, and where that's not possible. In fact, I won't resort to cut integrals. I'll simply go straight back to the formula for the RPA correlation energy. So that's the plan, and now let's do it. This is not a new calculation. I thought it was, but it was done in the 70s at least. So what we do is we first calculate the bare response chi-naught, and because I'm going to be interested in two tubes that are very long compared to the distance between them, it turns out that at a distance d apart, q of order 1 on d is the important q's. It's the peak of the interaction when you integrate over q, where q is a wavelength along the wire. So I'm going to use the lowest order in q expression for the bare response of the electrons, and this is trivial. This is a free electron responding to a field. This is simply f equals ma. The a is the second time derivative. There's the second time derivative of the position, and the density is in fact the gradient of the change in position of different particles, and you're responding to a potential and not a field. That's why there's an extra factor of q. So this is an absolutely trivial independent free electron, but it's also true in quantum mechanics to lowest order in q. So this is true whether your electrons on your 1D wire are quantum mechanical, classical, or what. The quantum mechanics is in fact irrelevant at lowest order in Q. And the model for semiconducting nanotube or wire is going to be kind of trivial. I'm simply pinning each electron down with some pinning frequency omega naught. It's the crudest possible model of an insulator. These bare responses, this one diverges as omega goes to naught, this one does not. Now we simply write the... let's look at the single tube first so we understand the plasmons of a single tube. And that's simply done from the RPA equation. The density change is the bare response times the total field. And eventually we're going to throw away the external field and find the frequencies that will naturally respond. A typical RPA-type response for the screened response out of this RPA equation, chi-naught over 1 minus interaction. Now, in 1D, the Coulomb interaction, Fourier transformed, is a strange beast. It depends on the width of the wire, basically. Here, A is the width of the wire. 2a is the width of the wire. In other words, the Coulomb potential has a singularity at z equals z prime, which you can't Fourier transform until you make the wire have a finite width. The plasmon frequencies are simply the zeros of this denominator. It's the determinant in the very general arbitrary geometry case. And it comes to 1 minus q squared log q on omega squared. Now, if you compare it for a 3D gas, of course, that denominator, screening denominator, otherwise known as the... Pardon? Sorry about that. This is basically a 1D frequency squared over omega squared, and that 1D frequency, thank you. Oh, I see, yes, that's nice.
Don't look at this.
Yeah, don't look into it, right? All right, just to press, okay. Yeah, I don't use these much. Okay, so this is just basically omega P1D squared over omega squared, and the effective plasma frequency in 1D is basically an acoustic relation, except there's a logarithmic correction from the Coulomb log. Okay, so whereas if you follow through the same mathematics for this case, you get this frequency squared plus omega naught squared, square root of, so this goes to a finite frequency as Q goes to naught. Okay, so that's one wire. Now you simply have to couple the two wires. Again, you need the Fourier transform of the interaction between two wires. The Coulomb interaction comes out a K naught function, but basically it goes off exponentially with distance. Then you write a pair of coupled RPA, random phase approximation equations, solve them, you get the coupled plasma frequencies, and now we're going to write the separation dependent part of the energy of the system as the sum of the even plasmon zero point energy, the odd plasmon zero point energy, minus the energy at infinite separation. In the insulating case, you look at these two terms tend to cancel each other. In fact, this is a second order expression by tailoring to second order in the small interaction compared to omega naught, you get this, and very quickly by dimensional arguments you pull out a factor 1 on d fifth. So the answer for insulating wires from this trivial RPA type of energy argument is indeed 1 on d fifth. Now what happens if you take that pinning frequency to zero? Obviously this can't work because the pinning frequency is on the denominator. You can't expand it that way, you have to expand it a different way, same formula. And what happens now is that you, again, Taylor expand to second order, this difference of frequencies, you get this expression. And, all right, this k naught x is a Bessel function. Immediately, just from QDQ, from the phase space arguments, 1 on d squared pops out. Question is, do you get any more dependence on d? This function x, k naught x, is a function which basically, as a function of x, which is dimensionless wave number, has a strong peak at, I don't know, at x equals 2 or something like that. 2.39. And since the log varies slowly and this varies fast, we simply fix this the value where the rest of it gives you a maximum. So an asymptotic approximation, and here's where your log comes from. It's from Taylor expanding that square root to second order. Who was asking about where the log 3/2 comes from? It comes from the second order Taylor expansion of the square root of a logarithmic term. Yeah.
So this is due to the plasmons now.
Yep.
If we would increase the separation between these wires, and let's say they are metals, mm-hmm. and so we would need information about the low frequency response, and let's assume that would be described by a Drude model.
Well, that's what I've. Well,
different divergence if omega tends to zero.
I think you'll find is that if the mean free path is long compared to the distance. I thought about this. If the mean free, don't think frequency space. That's an artifact. Think of the mean free path, because in fact, what happens in metals with defects is some of the states are localized. That's where, in fact, the finite conductivity comes from. If you think of a mean free path longer than the distance between them. Now, there are measurements many years ago, in fact, when nanotubes started being produced, that showed that the mean free path in some nanotubes is huge, microns. And so a micron-long piece of two wires separated by much less than a micron is well within the regime of validity of what I've done here, where you ignore the damping.
Yeah,
so in principle, at very, 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 very large distances, maybe this would then come in. But you'd have to be further apart than the mean free path.
Right, so that would be somehow relevant probably to the target limit, but... So then you would get...
I'm going to talk about retardation here in a minute.
It depends on the model you choose, right? If you would have a different divergence in the dielectric...
Oh, yes,
response,
absolutely.
You would get a different divergence.
But the model is not an arbitrary one. It's one based on the lowest Q response of a metal.
Just wondering if this is in what sense...
No, this is where it comes from, all right? But it also comes from the strong Q dependence of that singularity. All right, so here are the issues for that, whether it's a sensible thing. Firstly, many people will probably tell me that it's stupid to use RPA for a 1D metal because that's a Luttinger liquid. That may be true. The single particle excitations may very well be suppressed. But in fact, Leon Dasama showed in 92 that the collective oscillations of electrons on a 1D metal are really pretty much as in RPA, provided you are in the long wavelength limit. And so, in fact, I talked about this in Melbourne in the beginning of 2007, and Drummond from Cambridge was there, and he decided to go away and model two 1D metals in diffusion Monte Carlo, and he basically verified what we're saying here. Incidentally, the result wasn't new with me. We thought it was, but it was done in the 70s, as I said, so he's not really verifying me. He's verifying Drummond and somebody else, a different Drummond from the 70s. Retardation, that's an interesting one. If it weren't for the logarithmic term, you'd have this Coulomb generated, the springiness of the electrons on the wire, of course, are generated by Coulomb, as well as by their own Pauli stiffness, but the velocity of that dispersion relation is much less than the speed of light. And it's only the logarithmic correction which could make the electrons ever respond faster than the light, the time it takes light to go between the two. So if you allow for the logarithmic correction, you get a distance at which retardation cuts in is exponentially large, e to the 9,000 times the width of the wire. And so I don't think, because these are very slow things, these plasmons on the wires, I don't think retardation is going to be an issue here at any distances where the force is big enough to measure, unlike the 2D case. I tried to do some estimates here. The problem with this wonderful power law, although it falls off far slower than the conventional one on our fifth law, is that these are only, for example, for a 5.5 nanotube, only one-fifth of the electrons participate in this. And secondly, the coefficient of the slow power is smaller in some sense than the coefficient of the D5. And so I figured that... if you put two wires of length 255 nanotubes at a distance 24 angstroms, I estimated that the plasmon force from this is 10 times bigger than the conventional one, which comes mainly from the other electrons that aren't the conducting lot, and that the plasmon force here is not very big. It's 10 piconewtons for these 1 micron lengths, but that is measurable these days if you can get rid of the other charging and millions of other effects. So it's conceivable to measure this directly, I think. Yes. Well, the point is that the other electrons can't screen these long fields, so they're not active in that region of Q. All right, I'd like to turn now to the case of the other case, which I still believe this one's new. I've not found anybody 30 years ago that did this one. This is the case of two graphenes. So I've drawn one of them here. Graphene, as you know, is a hexagonal network of pure carbon. There's a related compound, boron nitride. This guy has a electronic band structure. These are one electron block state energies that I'm plotting vertically in the kx, ky plane of motion in the plane. And there's this wonderful so-called capital K point in the Brillouin zone where the electrons are fill up to this point, but there's no density of states there, so it's neither a metal. By contrast, boron nitride is a proper insulator with occupations like this, and you could imagine doping one of these or just making a two-dimensional electron gas somewhere here would be a generic kind of energy diagram and occupation shown.
What was capital K that you were...
Capital K is this point where the it's a point in the Brillouin zone where the two bands touch in graphene. It's a symmetry-dictated, non-avoided crossing. And you break the symmetry by putting different atoms on the two points in the unit cell. And so there you don't get a crossing. Here you get this non-avoided crossing. This is the famous thing which very, very well verified that the one-electron physics of graphene sheets correspond to this kind of band structure diagram. So now what I did was I said, all right, let's take that as true, and we're interested in the low Q, low frequency excitations. I'm not going to go through this working. I managed to calculate from detailed solid state theory that the bare response of this system is somewhere halfway between a metal, which blows up at any Q, blows up for small u. U is imaginary frequency. Insulator doesn't blow up for small u at all. This is probably too low for many people to see, is it? I'm sorry about that. I wonder what we can do about it. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, that's good. That's good. At least some people can now see. We put it right down the middle, maybe. Put it right down the middle. There we go. All right. So as you can see, this blows up, but only when both. The contribution to the dielectric function is not, in fact, from kynoid. It's from the polarizability, which is the thing with the Q squared knocked off. So this thing is divergent only when both Q and omega go to naught. So this is a different class, if you like, of divergences. And let me show you quickly what the mathematics looks like. I'm not going to show you the mathematics which went down from the general formula for RPA energy to the formula for two separated sheets. But here it is. This is the screen version of that kynoid I just showed you. Here's the interaction between the two planes. That gets squared. So log 1 minus, basically these are like reflection coefficients squared, which you probably are familiar with from some other versions of the van der Waals or Casimir treatment. So this is the formula. By the way, the thing about this response function is, if you look at it, it has no plasmons. If you take this to the real axis, say this is I times the frequency. If you take this to the real axis, it doesn't give you any plasmons. So in other words, the motions of this system are not springy at low Q and low U. They're soggy somehow, but they're still there. They're still fluctuations which can correlate and give you some energy, and here's the expression for it. Now, in this expression, the essential thing is that the frequency appears only in this form, U over Q. The other dependence on Q, these go away, is only on QD. So by going to those dimensionless variables, without even evaluating this integral, you can see what the spatial dependence is. It gives you, you go to a variable, just call this X and call that one Y, and you get a dimensionless integral of X and Y. Take out all the dimensional factors, QDQ, and another factor from here of the D, and you get D to the minus 3. So it's a purely scaling argument. The constant, of course, you'll have to actually evaluate the integral. So there's the answer, and it follows from scaling because the small q and u response depends essentially only on the ratio of q to u. Of course, at any finite frequency, you'll get some holes and electrons, and there'll be a crossover into the 2D metal case, which is a difference. So just to remind you, two-dimensional gases gives you d to the minus 2.5. Two insulators in a planar geometry gives you d to the minus 4. So this is, not surprisingly, somewhere in between a metal and an insulator case. Very quickly, we also did some numerical calculations here because these were finite length systems. We were actually interested in the fact that making two nanotubes metals could substantially increase their attraction, so we kept the distance fixed but made longer and longer tubes. And what you would expect from a 1 and R6 model is that the interaction between them should saturate quickly as you make L longer. In fact, as soon as you make L substantially bigger than D, a 1 and R6 interaction would make the force or the energy no longer increase with wire length after quite a short wire. What we found from a plasma model, and here to, I'm not going to give you all the details, the one thing about here that I need to mention is we did include the electron degeneracy pressure. P is some kind of characteristic velocity of these electrons on the wire, the Fermi velocity, if you like. Now, I'm sorry if this is such a busy slide, but let me... where will we start on such a busy slide? Right, just reminding you, this axis is the length of the tube. That's what's changing. The distance d between them in this graph is fixed. So what we're interested in is what happens as we look at the energy of van der Waals interaction between two wires at fixed distance as a function of the length of the wire. First of all, let me start with the insulating case with a big gap put in as a pinning frequency in the way I showed you before. And as expected, the energy saturates rapidly as a function of length. Now let's go straight away to the fully metallic case where there's no gap. And we found the energy as a function of length not only is much bigger, but doesn't saturate well at all. I'm not even sure what the analytic form for this is. It might be quite interesting, actually, Maron, to know what this is. The analytic... It's probably a logarithm. It looks very slow, certainly. So that was interesting. So what we showed here is that you can get force laws that are obviously different as a function of length, and you can get attractions that are much stronger for a metallic tube than a pinned or insulating tube. We also did a little experiment in which we made very short tubes, all of them metallic, but allowed no contact. So, and we calculated by the fully non-local screening equations, et cetera, et cetera. So there's always a fully non-local calculation via RPA type methods, some of plasmons, in fact. And when we did that, we got essentially the same result as for an insulating highly pinned wire. So it's preventing the electrons from moving along the wire, which makes the difference here between the insulating and metallic response. Just finally for this case, we also looked at the other case where you kept wires of a fixed length and changed the distance between them. So this is the distance between the tubes. And not surprisingly, because now these systems have a finite screening kind of length associated with them, the energy doesn't diverge when they touch. So this is an example of the second kind of way where non-locality can be interesting, because we put the pressure in, we get some kind of a screening length here, and in that case the energy obviously goes by a slower power law than some reciprocal power, because it's finite when they touch. So that's an example of the second kind of funny thing that happens from non-locality. Some collected results. There are a few things here I haven't talked about yet, but the colours haven't come out. That's annoying. So the odd ones are two 1D metals parallel to each other, two pi conjugated layers. Here's the standard result, -4, -3. One I didn't talk about, one metallic layer and one pi layer, so one thin metallic, one thin pi. We get an extra logarithm compared to this one. 2D metal and a thick metal, d to the -5/2, the same as two thin metals, in fact. Graphene and a thick metal, so this is graphene above a metal surface. In fact, it's slightly altered. It's got a logarithmic correction compared to the pure case. And my postdoc's been interested in experiments on graphite, which don't seem to agree with each other very well. People can get a number of different results varying by almost a factor of 2 for the energy of adhesion of graphite. And he's shown that at least in the simple kind of models that we make, which are admittedly not really adequate for overlap graphite, but he found that the energy of what we call cleavage, where you have a bulk graphene in both the graphite in both directions and chop it, cleavage, doesn't have the same power law with cleavage distance d as pulling one sheet off. Not just different qualitatively, but different quantitative. Sorry, not just different coefficient, but different power. And here it is. Whereas if you stretch uniformly with all the layers stretched, you get back to what you had for two single graphene. So there's some interesting stuff here, and the experiments for energetics of pulling graphite apart might have to be rethought. This is all a result of the non-locality of the response in a layer. All right, so this is just a reminder of a slide I showed earlier. Here's a few recent references. And I'm not showing this now, but when this gets put up on the web, there'll be several pages of our papers there if you want to see different work that we've done on this. So that's what I'd like to leave you with, what I think needs to happen to get what I call strange van der Waals power laws. Thank you.
The RPA and Luttinger. So I have to say, I do find it surprising that the RPA, dielectric, is describing well the Luttinger.
If you'd like a trivial model, I can give you a trivial model for why, but you mightn't believe it. Let's think about a very classical picture of electron. But these correlations are mostly of classical origin. They haven't got a lot to do with quantum mechanics. Let's think about 3D, where electrons can avoid each other easily by not colliding head-on. The Coulomb interaction in that case can be at least reasonably thought to be a perturbation, right? In some sense. I mean, it's not quite at long wavelengths, but at least for most collisions, it's a small effect.
In
1D, they're all head-on, and in fact, Coulomb is infinitely high at contact, so electrons can never pass each other, all right? So anything that was single electron like a single electron being excited and moving faster in the absence of the others, it just doesn't exist in 1D. It's going to carry all of them with it. On the other hand, the 1D analog of things like plasmons, where the electrons don't really move through each other, they just do something like this and Coulomb provides the stiffness, that's still there in one dimension. The only thing you can't do is move them singly. But if you're looking at long wavelength collective modes, there's nothing so special about 1D compared to 3. That's my hand-waving argument, why that's true for long wavelength collective only. Collective modes where electrons crossing each other are not of the essence for creating the density disturbance.
Could you remind us, what is the plasma spectrum in one dimension?
In one dimension, it was this log thing. I think it's to the half from memory. So it's quite what I call quasi-acoustic.
I think the answer to the question is that if we didn't have a Coulomb interaction, then we just had omega equals ck due to the short-range interactions. But if you have a Coulomb interaction, it makes the system a little bit stiffer.
Yep.
And it just happens that it's unsized with... Mm-hmm.
But this C is also due to Coulomb, and it's got an E squared in it.
Right.
Yeah. So the main stiffness is Coulomb.
The spectrum of plasmons in one dimension is the same or identical to the spectrum of density fluctuation.
Yeah. I have another question, if I may. So now, let's say you want to describe this situation where you have your nanotube. The situation you described where you kind of look at their interaction when they're kind of pointing.
Oh, yeah, the pointing geometry. That's exactly what we call it, pointing.
So could you address that in some other way where you basically take a Luttinger liquid and impose some kind of... You take some region in the middle and do something to it. So you freeze it out somehow, but... Well, the problem would be, of course, that all interactions are local there, so...
Yeah, you're going to... It's going to be a hard problem mathematically just because of the broken translational symmetry.
No.
That's why we did ours numerically, in fact, because the maths was hard.
Something like Kane-Fisher or something like that, which may affect conductance.
I would be interested to see such a calculation. I should mention, by the way, that...
Liquid is Coulomb interaction, just marginally off because of the law.
Right. So the question is, can you?
I think you're saying, imagine start from a wire with this kind of interaction, and then just cut out the piece.
Yeah.
Out of
mm-hmm. it. Yeah.
And the question is, what is the interaction between them?
Right.
It induced because you cut out
right.
the piece.
Right. What is the change in energy?
Right.
Yeah. So that would be interesting.
And I think it will be inverse in the size you cut out with mm-hmm. log correction.
Yeah. Anyway, it would be interesting.
Yeah.
I should confess that, of course, although I claim that the lowest order in Q is correct in these perhaps Luttinger liquids of one dimension, in order to treat the finite size, I had to go to the next order in Q and introduce the plasma pressure. Already, I think that's strongly subject to question. So that I'm not nearly as sure of those results for finite pieces of wire as, because of possible Luttinger-type effects as I am sure of this case. And anyway, in this case, we've got a diffusion Monte Carlo calculation from Needs, who fully expected to find something different, I think, because he didn't buy my argument about the long wavelength modes, but he in fact found agreement with us. So we felt happy about that. But I think this case with finite lengths and pointing is possibly different. And I wouldn't trust our calculations for that nearly as much. Sorry, Roger.
So let's do other questions first.
Yep.
Well, I just wanted to ask you about the retardation for the graphene sheet.
That's very... I'm not sure. I think that's probably okay. Retardation for the metallic sheets is... Well, if you regard retardation as a problem, it's quite a problem. There's only a fairly narrow range where they're far enough apart... for the two 2D metals, the D minus 5 halves law, where they're far enough apart that they're not comparable to the distance between electrons and before you get into retardation again. So that's been worked out by Sernelius and company. There's a relatively narrow range where you'd have to do an experiment where retardation wouldn't cut in. For the graphene case, something I was going a bit too fast, I skipped over it, but if you look at this dispersion, there's a slope here, which is V naught, sometimes called the Fermi velocity. I think that's a wrong word for it in graphene, but it's a characteristic velocity of graphene, and that's a lot less than C. And my suspicion is basically... my suspicion is that the matter... let me think. You see, the thing is, in these interactions, the cues that are important are of order 1 on D. And because of that and because of a constant velocity, if you compare the time that light is taken compared to the time the matter is responding on the two sides, it'll always be in the ratio of V on C, I think. So this case, the graphene, I think you shouldn't be strongly affected by retardation, but the fully metallic case will, because there you get a velocity which goes like the square root of Q, and that of course can be as large, the derivative, the group velocity can be as large as you like when Q is small, and so there you do have to worry about cases where the light transit time is longer than the matter response time, and that's the retarded case. So to summarise, I don't think retardation is a big issue for the two wires, metallic, or for the graphene planes at T equals naught, but as soon as you get to finite temperature, the little piece that comes from the electron hole plasma, thermal electron hole plasma, which is a 2D metal, will be very much subject to retardation. So that's my best guesses. I wouldn't stake my life on any of those statements, but they're my best guesses. Jenny?
So there is no speed of light in your formulas at all.
No.
In the regime you can see. So is it fair to say that these effects are just the consequence of the fact that if you look at given geometry, then there is change in the plasmon zero point motion. And
well, that's the whole. Where possible, that's how you do it. Yeah.
Casimir effect just in a different medium.
Yeah.
In a medium with different dispersion.
Well, as I showed you, there are some cases where there are not well-defined plasmons where perhaps that's not a good way to look for it. But in general, where there are well-defined isolated plasmon poles, that's essentially a perfect way of looking at it.
So that is going outside, in the outside space.
It's not relevant. It's the plasmons, basically the joint plasmons of the two, or in fact, in more specifically, the difference of their zero-point energy from the same zero-point energy when the systems are very far apart. So it is a difference technique, just like some of the Casimir techniques. But, you know, obviously this is very similar in spirit to doing the same thing for the EM field. And I don't think the connections are 100% understood yet, but it's obviously connected in some deep way to the...
Interestingly, yeah. If you look at the two wires and you take them to such a large separation that retardation should be important, then you would expect a universal amplitude, right? As you know, for two. I mean, then you could just assume that they are react like perfect metals.
I would think so, yes.
And then that's something we did a couple of years ago.
For wires, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And then you
that's
get
interesting.
Exactly the same 1/ distance squared behavior, yes, and 1/ log, but log has just a different power.
Very interesting. So it still wouldn't be got by a sum of 1 on R6, though.
So the interesting thing, there's no change in power law.
From the non-retarder. Usually there is, of course, isn't there? So this is an interesting case. Very interesting, yeah.
Another question related. So you considered always the length of the wires to be the largest scale in the problem, right?
Yes.
Did you look what happens if this becomes... finite,
Well, I did for this geometry, yeah. But for strangely enough, we haven't yet done it for this one.
For
so, I mean, that's something we can certainly do.
Actually rotate them against each other.
There, of course, you go from having an energy per unit length to just an absolute energy. And the funniness, quite funniness of these effects, excuses to Walter, it seems to be tied up with this sort of unusual parallelism of some kind always.
Right, so I was wondering if you tilt them slightly, do you lose immediately for a finite angle?
Well, if they're a finite length, you won't lose it immediately, but there'll be a trade-off between length and angle, after which you tend to lose this. So, that introduces a new length. Possibly the simplest way to look at it, if they're skewed off, there's an average length, but there's a d min and a d max, and maybe you could write it in terms of those. Some kind of relation between those. If d max and d min are both very close to d bar, you're probably still reasonably close to our results. But when they're not, well, obviously you won't be close.
Yeah.
That would be my guess, but that's only a guess. And I know that Roger and Rudy have in fact done some calculations for this geometry. And also for this, where I'm sure they've got some quite penetrating questions to ask me.
For for me.
Oh, I'm not finished, Jenny. Sorry, Jenny wasn't finished.
So the dispersion law which you wrote at the top, it's fairly close to dispersion law of electricity magnetism in just in one dimension. So I'm wondering.
So this is like spin waves, magnons.
You mean just electromagnetic waves. But
okay.
It's almost linear in Q.
Yeah.
So I guess there should be an answer coming from that which has its counterpart apart from logarithmic corrections in
you're talking about the sort of van der Waals effects in a single wire, these so-called critical Casimir type calculations.
My guess is that if you just have two half infinite wires, metallic wires separated by some distance, then the interaction between them should be of the form which you get just if I look at the two one-dimensional version of electricity and magnetism. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. I think to solve that case mathematically, you'd need to use something like the what's that called? The one-sided Fourier transform method. It's got a Wiener-Hopf. You'd need Wiener-Hopf, which would be quite messy with these cuts and poles around. But
you don't have a result for interaction of two metal wires separated by some distance.
Not two infinite. I don't have an analytic result for two infinite wires separated by a finite distance. I say that would require Wiener-Hopf, which is not so easy.
Trying to do that.
Did it work?
Well, no.
I think the answer has to be the same as I think the answer has to be repulsive one over distance interaction with law corrections, with possible law corrections.
Repulsive.
Yeah.
Wow.
No.
I hope we didn't get the sign wrong. I mean, I wonder if we checked the sign carefully in our calculations there. Is it conceivable that all those attractions I was drawing were actually repulsions? I don't think so, but it's possible. I mean,
it's ruled out by reflection positivity in this case.
Huh? So we're in
reflection positivity will rule it out in this situation.
Yeah, we're into realms where I have not much intuition, so you guys probably, from your so-called critical Casimir type calculations, probably have more intuition on this than I do. I think there might be some interesting cases here.
Space for the electrons to move, so they would.
I would just compare it with an interval. So if you have an interval which is almost harmonic, for the interval, there is a bulk term and there is a Casimir term. And now what I have is a system without the interval.
The thing is that this is not 1D sheets. I mean, it's 1D embedded in 3D. So in some sense, this is not an interval. This bit in the middle is
validate what I'm saying.
It's. I think what you're saying might be for sheets of charge moving like this. That's the truly one-dimensional case, in fact. And 1D embedded in 3D is not really 1D in the mathematical sense.
Let me ask you whether whatever is going on in the outer space is relevant or not.
I don't know. I think it's hard. I think it's not a 1D problem. Let's put it that way. Even though it's not a 1D problem in the sense,
the problem with trying to do Wiener-Hopf because it's not 1D. So you try to somehow, project it into a 1D problem. But then the kernels that you get, the operators that you get,
you can write it as 1D in real space, but it doesn't obey the Poisson equation in 1D. That's the point. So in Q space, it ain't so simple, as you saw from all logs and garbagey stuff. Well.
So a couple of different questions. When you looked at your two CNTs coming end on, did you check whether they were stable to displacement?
No, I didn't. We haven't looked at that at all. That would be
That
would be interesting. Do they attract each other or do they?
The analog of a dispersion torque that'll.
Oh yeah. Well, that's extremely interesting.
To see whether if there's a slight displacement, do they drive each other away or will they come back to?
Wow. Unless we made a mistake, I mean, it does seem to me that when they're collinear, it is an attraction. As you would expect from just drawing the dipoles, how they go. But I haven't thought about anything off axis because that's. Though, mind you, since we did this numerically, that's probably not much harder. So that would be a very good thing to try. Interesting, yeah.
Also, for me, since I'm usually always focused on real materials and how I can process things, so CNTs do them in water. And so I never actually think of 1/r^6 being present, that point by point perspective anything. I'm always seeing bulk materials. I want to get the interlayer medium shielding thing.
So I think that should preserve the form of 1NR6, though. I think that should, the shielding via the water, as long as it's a local screener, so to speak, should preserve the 1NR6 form, I think, in cases where the response of the two bodies is local enough for that to be true.
So the same changes in the bar-law will occur when there's water present throughout the system?
I would think so, because I think as long as the... You know, water can't do anything special at these very long wavelengths, so I wouldn't think it would reduce the coefficient of the interaction, but I doubt if it would change it, the power.
In the case where you had two different CNTs, those we'd see... If you had you have to have had identical CNTs.
I had identical CNTs. Right.
If you had different chirality CNTs, you could see.
Well, you'd have a metal and an insulator from my point of view then,
example. And depending on your liquid medium, you could be getting repulsions and attractions.
I'm ignorant on this. It's the intermediate medium that can cause the repulsion, is it?
Medium, if you just crank its optical properties up and down. You can make repulsions.
I wasn't aware of that.
I find it in your paper that you love, I think. It's also quoted.
Which one? The Gilashinsky paper. It's in there, is it? I can't claim to have read the whole paper. I skimmed it, I saw those diagrams, and I said, aha! So that's about my level of understanding of the Gilashinsky paper, I guess.
My take on that is that I like the 1956 paper because I can understand that one.
The original one with Lifshitz on his own, yeah.
Added on a lot of things.
Yeah.
A separate question, though, is that because you're doing all this from the plasma point of view, and just for two semi-infinite half spaces interacting, normally.
So this is metals? Half spaces. Thick.
But you've been discussing a lot about the effects due to these plasmon oscillations. Mm-hmm. And is there something that would be beyond normal Lifshitz for two semi-infinite half spaces? Could arise from surface plasmons?
No, well, the surface plasmons, again, they're also what I call optical. They have a finite frequency at 0Q. It's omega p on root 2 for a simple model. And again, that's what I call normal behavior. So I have no argument with Lifshitz for two metals. He gets one on D squared. I agree with him.
And
in fact, Ninham, I think, was it Ninham, made quite a profession out of treating objects by the coupling of their surface plasmons, which again, for bulk surface plasmons on bulk systems are not anomalous in the sense that I'm talking about.
And they give the